Hey, so no real updates from Tuesday. Pretty much the same story. Just getting the UCs out as quick as I can. The AREs are all out there, so all the reading assignments. That's the drop seven. I just have it written as drops five to be consistent, but for this semester, it's at least seven. And group project, that's kind of the next big deliverable. Wednesday is the last week of classes. So there's this week, there's Thanksgiving week. So there's only one, I'll get to your question in a second. There's only one lecture, which will be our social behavior lecture. That'll be the last new content lecture. So if you're doing your kind of attendance math, you can sort of, figure out, how worthwhile it'll be to be in person or not. I'll be here. Then, of course, there's the break. And then it's last week of classes. And so Tuesday will be the final exam review lecture. Wednesday is when all the project stuff is due. Thursday is when stage one is. Saturday is when the peer reviews are due. And then in finals week, that's when stage two is. Stage one, plan to make available at least Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Stage two, Monday through Friday of finals week. Question? I can do that this weekend. No, you don't need film. If you have film, that might be good. I think a picture would be great. Doesn't have to be a picture you've taken, but 10 minutes long, no more than that. Nobody's complained about a short presentation. Roughly speaking, you should have an introduction to the general context and the potential problem, and then fade into saying, so you're proposing to study a particular causal question and identify your causal question, and then somehow fold into that. And this is a little contrived, but it's a class thing. What level of explanation is that? So we plan to study the mechanistic causal question. How do mourning doves decide which grubs to eat or something like that. Then another short bit on then what hypotheses you are planning to discriminate with your experiment, and then a short bit on what experiment you plan to propose, and then a short bit on what predictions would come out of that experiment for each one of those hypotheses. And then you sort of close with just a little bit of synthesis to say, and these are why we're looking for these resources so that we can do this experiment to answer this and then remind us of your question. So that's the way the rubric is basically going to be structured. Are you on time? Did you motivate the problem? Did you give us the causal question? Did you identify at least one hypothesis? Did you set up an experiment? Did you provide predictions for that experiment? And that those are the key points. And so that's going to be, let's say 5 points each or something. So each one of those weighted about the same. No, well, so it kind of depends on how much detail you put into the organism one. Some people are more detailed than others. All I was looking for that in that initial assignment was two paragraphs where it was like, this is our organism, and these are potential problems that the organism might have when interacting with humans. And that basically says these are sort of things we might study. Some people got in more detail. So if you went into more detail where you already had a causal question, you had hypotheses, and you had an experiment, then you basically did everything and you're just finding a way to present that, not to me, but imagine it's to a stakeholder who's got, a certain, $10,000 to give or something like that. And then how would you convince them to fund your study? Well, so again, it's on, see, have them all split out, like what type of causal question it is, and then specifically, so if we're asking this how question, then there are these three potential answers. So we're testing hypothesis A, hypothesis B, hypothesis C. We are going to study these birds in different areas of the city. And by studying these birds in different areas of the city, then under these different hypotheses, we're going to get different predictions. And so you'd have to split all of those things out.
Okay.
That is, it's up to you. So I do, I mean, these presentations, I've been doing online presentations in a lot of classes I do. And you know, generally people use a tool like Zoom to record them. You don't have to all be in the same room. You can be connected remotely. Maybe that's an easy way for you all to have good audio quality. But you can be, it just sort of has to have, make a compelling presentation. So, you know, try to at least take it seriously as if, you know, like I have to write, you know, grant proposals for larger amounts of money, and they're usually like 15-page papers. And you know, I have to motivate these things, and people read that and decide I'm willing to give you money for that. And it's sort of like try to imagine this. You know, there are some sponsors of mine that ask me for slides primarily, and not, you know, but in that case, they don't actually ask me to present the slides. They just ask me to give them the slides. So this is sort of kind of in between that, you know, it's like an elevator pitch, but it's a little longer than an elevator pitch that, you know, how do I kind of make this compelling? And if that's a Canva presentation for you, a PowerPoint presentation for you, you know, however you want to make it, it's probably not going to be that compelling if it's just a gallery view of Zoom of, you know, four people sitting there and then kind of tossing off kind of conversationally. But maybe there's a way to make that work, but I'm guessing for most people, they'll come up with a short slide deck of, you know, of a few slides. And then I would say, you know, if you do the slide deck thing, some just general tips. So don't put as many words on your slide as I do here. These are lecture slides, so they're meant to be references. So, you know, more graphics than not. For a short presentation, don't waste your time on an agenda slide or an outline slide, because all of your outlines will be identical if you do them right. They'll be the same format that I just said. So don't spend a minute, you know, just going over, like telling me all the things that I just told you. Just go right into it. Like, we are interested in the Kit Fox. Here's a picture of a Kit Fox. And here are all the ways in which the Kit Fox is observed around Phoenix, and so on and so forth. And there's potential modifications to the Kit Fox's behavior because of these anthropogenic factors that they interact with. And so we're asking the question. And I just, you know, and note that your causal question doesn't have to reference the human stuff. Like, the human stuff motivates why you're asking the question, but the question is more foundational typically. So your causal question shouldn't be necessarily how do, you know, interactions with humans affect whatever. It really could be, you know, how do mourning doves prefer color for nesting sites? And you could say, you say, well, why does that have to do with humans? Well, it might be that in urban settings, there's a whole lot more of a particular color that you don't see in the wild. And because it's novelty in the wild, the birds are really attracted to it in the wild, but they're sort of maladaptively attracted to the common occurrence in the urban setting. So the causal question doesn't reference the human stuff, but is motivated by the human contact. So keep your causal questions simple and hopefully fundamental or foundational, and keep your hypotheses short as direct answers to those causal questions, and so on and so forth. And I'm sorry if I didn't mention that. I should put that in these, but I would say that your presentation, that's going to be, 10 minutes will be the max. If you can do it all in less, that's even better. Next is Thanksgiving week. So next is Unit J and Thanksgiving. And then everything's due the week before finals week, the last week of class. Other questions? Is that a half hand? My plan is to help facilitate people's travel plans and things like that, is to that last week of class, have stage one ready Wednesday. So you have all of Wednesday, all of Thursday, all of Friday. And I haven't decided if I want to do Saturday or Sunday, but I mean, I could. There's not really that much of a difference to me to have it available Saturday and Sunday too. I have a feeling most people would rather be available more than less. And then month and then again, because it's auto graded, I can give you all of finals week because I'll be busy dealing, not dealing with grading your final project and final projects for the other classes I teach. So that I'm just happy to just let you sit and stew with stage two for as long as you need, and then as long as you have it in by Friday, then that'll be fine. Questions, others? We cover everything here. But yeah, this is last week of classes, the very last week right before finals week. So Tuesday after Thanksgiving, Wednesday after Thanksgiving, Thursday after Thanksgiving, Saturday before finals week, finals week. And I think it's on the calendar. I'm pretty sure because this is late in the day on Tuesday, Thursday, our final exam slot on finals week is on Thursday. So this room will be staffed then if you want to come here to work on your collaborative stage two, but you don't have to. If nobody shows up within 15 minutes, same thing with stage one, probably we'll leave. I mean, even if you showed up and we weren't here, I don't think anybody's going to complain if there's students in a unstaffed room because we don't have to proctor, but that is an option, but you don't have to. You don't have to come to class. It's just like the midterm. For stage one and stage two, you don't have to be here. Yep. No, stage one, like I said, it'll open. It's just like the midterm. It'll open Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and you'll have 90 minutes from whenever you start. No, on Thursday. So stage one, that last week of class, it'll be open actually. I'll open it Wednesday. So stage one is the week before. Stage two is during finals week. Stage two is technically that's when we have this room, but I'm going to make it available all week and it's just going to be open. And that's the open book, open notes, collaborative one. So you can just, right. So you could work on the first couple of questions on Monday, the second couple of questions on Tuesday, whatever, go back and forth. And then I'll also make it available as a multi-submission. So if you do happen to submit and think, oh shoot, I want to go back, you'll have to then submit a whole new submission and we'll grade the latest, not the highest. But if you just leave it open, yeah, you can just leave it open and work on it all week if you want. Anything else? Okay. So let me refocus here on PowerPoint. Oh, and there we go. Okay, so last time we were talking about the sort of sex, the reason for sex, the reason for sexes, and one of the things we talked about was in anisogamous species. So these are species that have gametes of two different sizes, which implicitly means they have two different sexes, where we're defining sex as the physiological entity that produces either the small gamete, which we're going to call male, or the large gamete, which we're going to call female. And we talked about, well, why did this happen? Because a lot of unicellular organisms have just a single size gamete that they just release into the water or into a medium, and those gametes meet, and that's how they have sex. And so there are no male or female of these particular types of organisms. And so how did multicellular life end up getting these two different sexes? Now, I should mention that there are organisms outside of the animal kingdom that have like there are myxomycete protists that have like eight different sexes and all sorts of weird compatibilities and things like that. And that is super interesting stuff. And if you talk to a protistologist like Jillian Guile, who's a faculty member here in Souls, and tell you all about those sorts of things and all of the neat interactions there and how all that is mitigated. It's animal behavior, so we're sticking to multicellular organisms and animals in particular. So we're kind of keeping it simple, but nature is more complex than the animal kingdom, and so there is even crazier stuff out there. And if we were to find life on other planets, it could potentially be even crazier. But This is sort of a simple example here where we've got these two sexes, small and large. And this is a neat example of disruptive selection. At least that's the theory behind it, in that you can be perfectly fine having, intermediate gametes, but there are strategies, and this will relate to another continuum that we're going to see a little bit later. But there are strategies that force you to make trade-offs. But if you're willing to pay the cost of those trade-offs, you get benefits out of it. So if you're willing to become a smaller gamete, you can be much faster, which means you can find other gametes much quicker. But in order to become small and fast, you have to lose out on all of the nutrients and all of the potential control you can have that comes with having those nutrients. So if you basically get rid of all of the machinery it takes to build the eventual zygote and then the rest of the organism, then you're paying a huge cost because you give up a lot of potential control and influence, but you potentially could mate a lot more often. So you have a lot more opportunity to actually find a mate out there. So there's a benefit to going to the left here and becoming a small gamete, but there's also a benefit going to the right. And it's what we call a Pareto frontier, a trade-off space. There's no way to get better in one dimension without getting worse in another dimension. Or in other words, there's no way to get better in both simultaneously. So if you want to get better, you have to get worse. And so you have to get up to get down, so to speak. And so this disruptive selection basically then allows for subpopulations to make different choices. So instead of getting a stabilizing selection where everyone's an intermediate type, or instead of just everyone becoming one large type and it getting larger and larger and larger, then you get this split where you might start in the middle, but then you get this bimodal distribution where you get roughly half of your population going this direction, the other half going this direction. And that's why we think that we have not just sex, but two sexes in multicellular life. And so that sort of then puts this on this continuum from high short-term rewards to high long-term rewards. And so there's like no real advantage to be in this moderate. And that's why we don't see this sort of intermediate level here. We just see this side or this side. That's disruptive selection. So, different investments in reproductive physiology, so whether you go towards this side or go towards this side, lead to different behaviors and different signaling structures and so on and so forth. So, if you are invested in short-term rewards, there are downstream effects to that. If you're invested in long-term rewards, there are downstream effects to that. And so they basically, as an example, you might, as a male, on average in a population, tend to make different choices in terms of finding a mate versus a female. So one of the sexes might be choosier, might actually pay attention and make choices, while the other sex might be just looking for certain opportunities. And that may be male or that may be female. It gets complicated, as we'll see here in a second. And then the big thing that we're going to drill down into today is different investments in parenting. And so after the offspring are born, then how it does the investment continue? And how is it a shadow of what went on here or what went on slightly after this? And then also, what different types of conflict are generated by that? So, a lot of really interesting questions here. But this slide here, which is the old school way of thinking of it, makes it sound like everything's determined by the size of a gamete. But I think now we know that it's much more complicated than that. It's just not so simple as to say that because sperm are small and plentiful, then all males have to behave in a particular way. And likewise with females, it's just more complicated than that. And so, what are examples of that? So, the spermatophore provides one example that sort of challenges the way we have to think about this. So, we've got a Mormon cricket. And spermatophores are generated in salamanders and newts in a bunch of arthropods. The article that I'm having you read for this unit is about salamanders, and it's about female mate choice and how female mate choice can change through multiple matings. But it references the spermatophore that is deposited to the female from the male. The spermatophore is this giant ampule, this giant package that includes not only sperm, and not just one, but many, but also this nutritional package, which may, in part does, is it might be to serve the sperm, but in reality, the female then gets an opportunity to then use all that nutrition afterwards. And so, in some cases, these types of structures have been called nuptial gifts. So they provide an additional item for females to choose, but they also amp up the investment of the male. Question. No, it doesn't. This is it just has sperm in it. So, in the case of diploid organisms, then the it depending on what sperm meets the egg, then you're going to get different male or I mean, depending on the sex determination system, that's downstream from this. But this is that rather than just depositing sperm, naked sperm on their own, this provides a giant resource packet. It takes a male significant amount of time to generate that. And they're not just waiting there in the wings, ready to go. And it's not like the male can then just immediately go and mate again. The male, once it drops off its spermatophore, it has to wait a significant amount of time before it can produce a new spermatophore and have a new mating event. In males that produce structures like spermatophores, you see more evidence of selection by males in the females. So as the investment in the mating opportunity goes up, choosiness in the males goes up. Now, in this particular case, the investment by the female is still dominates the investment by the male. And so the female is choosier. That's why, I mean, this is the big reason why you can hear male crickets, but you don't hear the female crickets when you find a cricket, at night somewhere in your home. And it's because there's a lot of the pressure for sexual signaling is still highest on the male, but the male still has more ability to select or has more pressure to select a beneficial female than a male that doesn't use spermatophores. So again, it's just not simply the size of the gamete that determines it. Once you amp up the investment, it changes behaviors downstream from that. That's the one example, spermatophores. But things get even more complicated. Any questions about that? Be clear what the spermatophore is here. All right, so things get more interesting when we look at synaphic fishes. So these include seahorses, pipefish, and sea dragons. So what you're looking at here are both males. These are both pregnant males. So this group of fishes has a brood pouch that the female deposits her eggs into. And then the male can fertilize inside the brood pouch. So it sort of mixes with salt water. The male can then mix in semen, seal the thing up, and then the male carries the brood to term. And for a long time, people would say that that because of that, seahorse males are choosier than seahorse females, and females have to compete for the male. It turns out that's true for pipefish, but it's not true for seahorses. So it turns out that seahorse males still compete to get access to a female, and a female chooses among males. But pipefish, and these are related, pipefish males are the ones that choose the female, and the female displays to the male. So even here, the physiological structure of a brood pouch doesn't, explain the differences. And so what they've done is they've put basically seahorses in the equivalent of respirometry chambers, and they're able to actually measure the energy it takes to produce 1,000 eggs by a female, and then the energy it takes to then rear 1,000 eggs by a male, a pregnant male. And it turns out that in seahorses, it's still more investment by the female. But in pipefish, it's more investment by the male. So just simply having the spermatophore or having the brood pouch isn't enough to know exactly what the behaviors are downstream. But once we see these differences in behaviors, then we can test hypotheses, like maybe it's an energetic investment. And when you test that hypothesis, you do find that, aha, it actually is that for complex physiological and ecological reasons, the energy balance is that the female still put, even though the male is carrying the brood, it's thought that the male carries the brood because it actually allows for a greater production in throughput. So the female actually has a little bit more time it takes to produce more eggs. So the male can raise these and get them out while the female is sort of recovering from that, so she can start producing new eggs. And so this ends up being a strategy that makes these genes produce faster, but it even though that benefits those genes in terms of their reproductive success, it still is the case that the male holds the kind of energetic balance. So it's cheaper for the male, and so the female is choosier. But the opposite case over here. So it's super complicated to understand sex differences. It never should just be boiled down to the size of a gamete. And if you want to see examples of that, I got a video here on this next one. So this is just summarizing what I'm saying here. So here is one of these pipefish. This is a female's breeding sail. She can open that thing up, like a kind of a giant diaphragm, and display to the male. The male is the thin one. And eventually the male will accept her and then they'll mate. And so there's a process that's going on in subtle where she can deposit eggs along his brood pouch. So it's this beautiful display, this beautiful ornament on this female. And, and 30 years ago or longer than that, this sort of ornamentation, if you just saw and you didn't know anything else about their physiology, a lot of people would assume that that must be the male because it's got this giant kind of chameleon-like banner that it's displaying. But no, in this case, it's the female. So I think it's a really cool video. So questions about that? Yeah. That's exactly right. This is like anything we've talked about in terms of ornamentation in birds and honest signaling, just shift that over. And this is a way for the female to signal to the male. And, that may or may not, it's likely an honest signal, which is why it persists. Why it's honest, like those colors, like it may be that in order for that, for her to produce those colors, she needs access to a certain amount of resources. Like that might be a certificate that she has high fitness. But yes, it's exactly that. So, but instead of the ornamentation being shifted to the male bird side, where in that case, the females have higher investment, so the males compete for the females. Here, the males have higher investment, so the females are competing for the males. And then the females are depositing the eggs the same way the males would deposit sperm in other organisms. Okay. But yeah, things can get, flipped around and, who knows what's the normal way or whatever. It's the point is, that's why it's behavioral ecology. We really have to consider all of these different factors together before we can really start explaining these behaviors. So there's no simple rules or patterns. It's kind of the thing here. Once you get into parental behavior after mating, things can get even more complex. And the reason they get more complex is you've got more degrees of freedom. There's just more stuff you can do, more knobs you can turn. And then there's more opportunities for conflict because you've got parents and offspring. You've got offspring-offspring conflict. You've got parent-parent conflict. And then here are the other degrees of, you can choose how many offspring, you can choose how much to invest in each offspring. Again, how much to invest in each offspring in terms of timing. How many offspring to have now versus later. There's just a bunch of different things you can do. And so there's a bunch of different opportunities. So when we're thinking about what happens after we have the offspring, then we throw around these terms to help quantify these things. So we talk about parental care, which is just generally behavior devoted to feeding, protecting, and teaching offspring. But then we also talk about parental investment, for which parental care is a subset, where it's just, the parent could be investing in making new offspring, but instead they're investing in enhancing the quality of the current offspring. So that's what we mean by investment. It necessarily is a trade-off between making more offspring and enhancing current offspring. And then that relates to the bigger category of life history traits and life history theory, which the term life history traits are traits that describe over an entire lifetime reproductive strategies such as age at first reproduction, number of offspring, number of clutches in a lifetime, all of these things where it really helps you understand what is the reproductive output of an animal over its entire lifetime. And we bin those into life history traits. Now, when we talk about life history traits, we can put them together in suites of traits that we call life history strategies. So, as an example, an animal might have a shorter lifetime, but that particular animal might also produce a larger number of offspring per clutch. So, you might have an ecotype of bird. So it's this, maybe the same species of bird that when it lives in the North Atlantic, that ecotype tends to live 5 years less than the ecotype that lives in the Pacific somewhere, but it lays much larger clutches than the one in the Pacific. And so they both might have the same lifetime reproductive success or reproductive effort, but they've divided it up differently into different life history strategies. And we see these changes in suites, and we have to then ask, where do they come from? And this is where this kind of life history theory comes into play, where hopefully, how many people have heard of the terms R-selected and K-selected? So this is, it should be review from like 181. The R here stands for the reproductive rate. So how quickly does an individual produce offspring? The K here stands for carrying capacity, so but spelled in the German way, so with a K. So that represents kind of, are you limited in your resources? So this is sort of suggesting you're unlimited in the environment is not limiting you, so you can reproduce at whatever rate you want. This is suggesting that although you'd like to produce at a higher rate, the environment limits you due to carrying capacity or doing this just generally resource limitations. So you're kind of stuck with whatever rate the environment will allow. And so there are environments that impose R selection are environments that are tend to be unpredictable, have a lot of resources, so they don't constrain growth. They don't constrain maturation. They don't constrain reproduction. They allow for new strategies to just show up and then bloom. And then because they don't have a lot of competition. So you have a lot of coexistence of diverse strategies, possibly even in the same niche. So you might not have a lot of niche exclusion. You might not have a lot of competition. It's just very easy to move in and grow. So this is what we may R selected. And if you're an animal that has spent many generations in an R selected environment, you tend to have certain life history traits, certain life history strategies. And those strategies tend to be based on quantity, not quality. So each offspring gets very little investment, but you have a high number of offspring over the lifetime. And a potentially high diversity of offspring. So there's a bit of bet hedging here. So the idea here is that you just produce a ton of offspring that might have a wide variety of phenotypes, and then maybe relatively few survive to reproduce, but you're pretty confident that due to the abundance in the area, you don't need to be kind of fine-tuned. As long as you just get offspring out there, they're going to survive. And hopefully a lot of them survive, but it's kind of fine if they don't. But you're mainly just trying The reproductive strategy here is just assuming that resources will always be available and just pumping out offspring, quantity over quality. That's our selected behaviors and our selected physiology. On the flip side of that, K-selected, these environments are environments that are highly stable, they're highly competitive. So there's a lot of pressure for specialization and efficiency. Generally, across these communities, you have less diversity. So you're not going to see a lot of duplication inside a niche. There's going to be one organism that sort of is that niche. And then they're going to be so highly specialized that they're going to depend upon other specific organisms that are out there. So there'll be a high amount of interdependence. So these will be kind of fragile communities that if you manage to kill, one, if there's one species that gets really taken out by, climate change or something like that, it may cause the whole community to shatter because there's no redundancy, because everything is selected for efficiency. So a very different structure of these communities. And with that, it's a very different set of strategies to succeed. Here, it's really based on quality and not quantity. You're not pumping out any arbitrary offspring. You're pumping out an offspring that is meant to get a foothold in this highly competitive environment. So, how do you do that? Well, you might have a low number of offspring. Each offspring will get a high investment. So, instead of producing new offspring, you're spending a lot of time raising or preparing the offspring that you have. Those offspring will not be very diverse. They're going to be highly tailored to this highly competitive environment, highly specialized with advantages for this environment to ensure that when you only have two or three offspring over your whole lifetime, all two or three of those are going to survive to reproduce themselves. So here, you're okay with pitching a few offspring. Here, really, you don't want to lose that many because you've got a high investment in them and you really are counting on them surviving and reproducing themselves. So this is what we mean by life history theory. It is this idea that these different communities select for different behaviors. Any questions about that? And actually, interestingly, the Holling from Holling's disk equation is the same ecologist that did a lot of work in this area. So not only was working in optimal foraging theory and trying to understand all of that stuff, but simultaneously, so that was very empirical work, and then kind of with theoretical explanations, was also working at a highly theoretical level, trying to understand the structure and dynamism and trajectories of these communities. So really prolific individual Holling was. So a lot of interesting stuff that came out of that. Yeah. That's a go ahead. That's a great question. So there was a it was sort of the observation that it seems like organisms that come to mind that fit this suite of behaviors tend to be smaller, like insects, and organisms that fit this suite of behaviors tend to be larger. And I would say that pattern is generally true. I think you find that larger organisms tend to live longer and be able to produce longer. So there, it's less about let's just push out a clutch, a giant clutch right now, and then get out of it. It's more about let's develop. You've got a long sort of gestation rate, a long time to maturity. Push that one out, make sure it's supported. Now let's start on the new one. And that I think a lot of times just takes, so there are a bunch of, I mean, if you look up life history theory, rich, rich area, and it addresses this idea behind scaling and how it relates to life history theory. And absolutely, those signals are there, and there's a lot of good justifications for why they're there. Any other questions? Okay, so I mean, let's look at some potential consequences of these things. So these are baby American coots. So coots, you can see a lot of around Phoenix, a lot of places. They look a little like ducks. The The chicks look particularly fuzzy. The adults are not this fuzzy and colorful at all. They're, we're kind of black with these sort of yellow beaks. They look ducky, but they're not actually very closely related to ducks. They make kind of their own little noises too. Very recognizable. But like I said, the offspring, highly colored, and they look a little funny. The interesting thing about these coots is that they are a great example of sibling rivalry and sibling conflict. It turns out that in these American coots, this coloration, which you only see in the chicks, appears to be honest signaling to the parent of which one they should invest in. And so what you find is that so if you go and artificially trim the feathers off this coot to make it less bright, so it looks like it has darker feathers, it then the parent of that coot will then shift its investment to the other one. And so the thought here is that there's, and we'll bring up this, I guess I'll just bring it up now, this insurance egg hypothesis is that this strategy evolved in a K-selected environment where it was there's a high chance that your offspring are going to die because they're going to be limited by these constraints. And so you do create a little one extra offspring, but you can't really afford to support both of them. So then by creating this diversity, then you try to determine which one is more likely to survive and then divert resources toward that one. And if you happen to be in an area that has enough resources, both will survive. But very often, the one that you're biased towards, you'll end up killing off the other one. And so that's an example of a K-selected strategy where you're trying to deal with the likelihood that a huge investment could be lost. And then so you're bet hedging a little bit by producing this extra one, but you don't want the extra one to be so costly. So then you look for other signals, honest signals of success, and then divert resources to the one that's likely to be successful. So that's an example of a particular strategy that, if this was R selected, you just pump out more and more and you wouldn't really, you wouldn't invest in them at all. You just pump out little ones and you'd send them out there and let them do their thing. And, but here, because it's K selected, you pump out a very small number and then gradually divert resources to one that looks like it's going to be successful. And they call that sibling rivalry as well. So you often will see, I think in this next slide here, you actually see siblings fighting each other. And there was often the question of why don't the parents get in the way of this? And the thought was that actually it's adaptive for the parents to allow the siblings to fight with each other. So in blue-footed boobies and actually a bunch of other birds, kookaburras and so on, then you find that the older chicks will aggressively peck at younger chicks. I mean, to the point, I mean, it's violent. And unless you're in very, very favorable environmental conditions, the younger chicks are often die. And so this is known as siblicide, siblings killing other siblings. And the parents permit this, or rather, genes that code for behaviors that would prevent this from happening were less successful because those birds that would prevent the siblicide actually end up not being able to, they might lose their whole clutch. So this is an alternative way of rather than honestly signaling who's going to get fed, then there's this other mechanism that sort of says that if the older ones are strong enough to kill the younger ones, can get rid of the younger ones. If the older ones aren't that strong, then let the younger ones come up because the older ones probably aren't going to survive anyway. So it's an example of siblicide that you see coming up in a lot of different animals that live in these difficult K-selected environments where the resources are really tight. So questions about that? Yeah, and the insurance egg hypothesis, producing a little extra, but then backing off that investment later. About life history theory, it's not a static thing. So you can actually change your life history strategy throughout your life. So, as an example, older organisms can invest in more in their offspring. What I mean by that is older, it might be younger organisms might just pump out a bunch of offspring and then don't invest in any of them, just sort of let them play, roll the dice. But as they get older, then they invest. So they're in the same environment. Nothing has changed in the outside environment. But as they get older, then they start investing more. And so they shift from quantity to quality. Why do you think that might be? How does life history theory give us a lens to understand the selective pressures that are added by being old near the end of life? What is similar about being old and living in a very constrained environment? In this environment, you definitely have limited resources to work. But when you're old, why do you have limited resources to work with? So if you have senescence, you might just be worse at all of the things you used to be better at. And then I think also once another really important resource that you have a lot less of when you get older. Any thoughts? And what specifically do you mean in terms of ability to reproduce? I'm looking for something more general. It's possible that you're limited in, but is there a more general resource that we don't often maybe think of as a resource, but it's a little softer. When I see lots of in the back. Time. And you're older. You just have less opportunity. And so, although around you, you might have all of the resources in the world, I mean, what's that phrase? You can't take it with you. Like if you've accumulated a bunch of riches, and then that's why people like, big universities like this or public radio stations or whatever have these people that, talk about estates and stuff like that, that try to, you're saying like, if you've accumulated all these resources, but you're at the end of your life, there's no way you're going to use those resources. So you may as well be poor because those resources, they're not the things limiting you. Your time is limiting you. And so you shift from being R selected, where if you're rich and young, you can do all sorts of things. But if you're rich and old, you've got this bucket list that you've got to worry about. And but now we're talking about it as like a reproductive bucket list. And so here you're, because you're much more limited, then you take that accumulated wealth in your environment and you invest it in more carefully in these offspring because you don't have a chance to make more of those offspring. So that's one example. It can. It doesn't always go this way. In organisms that have senescence, that as you get older, you become less likely to be able to do things associated with parenting, and then eventually you die, then this pattern is well explained by life history theory. So if we saw this pattern, it would make sense from a life history perspective. There are other interesting shifts, like as an example, there's an invasive termite in Florida. That there's a these there's a particular type. So termites are these they evolved from wood roaches, and so they're these nymphs. So they basically get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as they molt. And in higher termites, the certain group of termites, then there's a fork in their development where some of them become soldiers and they get these hard heads and these sharp mandibles, and they can defend the colony. And the rest of them maintain their soft bodies and they do all the other work of the colony. But it turns out that when you're a king and a queen of a termite colony and you dig that hole and you start building your incipient colony at the sort of the beginning of your lifetime, then you start pumping out workers. But if you only have 30 workers, and if 10% of your workers are these soldiers, then those like three soldiers, if an ant colony comes tunneling through, they're just going to destroy you regardless of how many soldiers you have. So what most termites do is early in their life, they don't produce soldiers. They only produce workers. And then in the middle of their life to later in their life, they start producing soldiers. So early in life, it's all about getting bigger. It's just we don't care. We're not protecting the investment. We're just getting bigger, getting bigger, getting bigger. Later in life, it's like we're now big. We now can afford to build a fortress of soldiers around us to prevent other things from getting in there. So they shift their development resources into these more expensive, but now valuable and useful soldiers. Now, this invasive species I'm talking about in Florida, what's interesting, they apparently are developmentally constrained that when they're young in life, they can't stop producing soldiers. So they just there's no way for them to modulate that. But the soldiers that they produce end up, so there's when we talk about these hemometabolous insects, each molt is called an instar. And so normal soldiers have like 13 instars, which means like they molt 13 times before they're done and they're adults. But the soldiers that get produced by these invasive termites in Florida, they at this stage, when they're young colonies, those soldiers pop out, but they harden after like 7. And when they harden, their mandibles are all like screwed up. They're like useless soldiers, but they mature very fast and they die very fast. So it's a little bit like, other termites have the ability to turn off soldier production until they need them. These termites don't have that ability. So instead, they kind of poison their own soldiers to make them kind of less costly. And that's the way that they've handled this life history switch. So there's a bunch of different mechanisms, but we can all explain why we get these differences from young to old or from R to K in terms of this very powerful life history theory. And so that's why this it's important to know when you think about looking at the diversity of behaviors across the animal world, is that a lot of the different pace of life that you see, could probably be explained, or at least you can at least get a hypothesis out of life history theory that you can then go and test. All right. So, any questions about this, about this idea that even within an organism's life, you can shift strategies? Okay. And then so, there's kind of a, and somehow, sometimes life history theory is interesting, and sometimes it's not the dominant explanation. So, this is sort of a famous example from Timbergen, these herring gulls. So, this is a juvenile herring gull here, an adult here. And so the juveniles hang out in the nest. Eventually, they get up and walk around and can leave the nest. Timbergen was able to show that when a juvenile is too young to walk around, the parent is unable to tell the difference between juveniles from its nest and other nests. But roughly around the same time that the juvenile can start walking around, then the parent is able to tell the difference between its offspring and other offspring. So it develops offspring recognition roughly around that same time that offspring start walking around. Why does that make sense? Anybody thoughts about that? Yeah. That's right. That's right. So there's no need to develop a, so the comment there was, if you know your offspring's not going to leave your nest, you don't need to develop a complex signaling mechanism to figure out who your offspring are. They're stuck in the nest. If they're there, you put them there. It's and so yeah, and this these sort of the inability to notice these things, could be exploited by things like cowbirds and stuff like that, like other birds will do that. But just in general, that most of the time, if there's something in your nest and it's small, you probably put it there. So you probably don't need to recognize other offspring that are small, because how would they get in your nest? But once your offspring can start walking around, then it's possible that an offspring from some other nest will walk into your nest and you'll feed it. Now, from the life history perspective, you might not have the resources to go and feeding all of these other unrelated offspring. So, from a life history perspective, if you think in terms of limited resources, it probably makes sense to develop an offspring recognition system when you need it so that you don't accidentally waste resources feeding offspring that aren't related to you. So that's fine. Any questions about that? Before we make the example more complex, I guess. So that's fine. That's like the classic example from Timbergen about this. But there are these, so these are, the difference here is these herring gulls are ground nesting. So you see them on the ground or whatever. But there are relatives of gulls that live up in the cliffs, like these kittiwakes here, that they live up on these ledges, and their nests are just, they're sitting on kind of the right inside that there. And because of that, it's really hard for predators to find them. So it's in some ways it's very advantageous. But on other on the other hand, it's easy to, if you can't fly, you fall off the edges of these things. So the interesting thing here is that although these are closely related to gulls, when they did the same experiments to see at what point do these kittiwakes start recognizing their offspring, it turns out that they never develop the ability to recognize their offspring. And not only that, you could even give them a closely related but different species offspring, and they also won't recognize it. So there might be a life history explanation that they're just willing to feed everybody, but that's probably not what's going on here. What do you think is actually going on here? Why do you think that these adults have never evolved the ability to recognize their own offspring? Right, that's a great, so the comment here is that in when you're living on the cliff's edge, if you're in the nest, that is an honest signal that there is no way you came from another nest. Because if you're a juvenile and you came from another nest, there's no way to get there because you've created a private nook for yourself. There's an evolutionary biologist, Joan Strothman, who is talks about how sociality, so much about sociality is, and so much about even the evolution of multicellularity is built off of the idea of privatization. Once you can privatize a resource, it totally changes the math. And suddenly things inside that privatized resource relate to each other very differently than things that can just randomly mix from the environment. And that's what's happening here. These cliff edges, this is your cliff edge. That's your apartment. Nobody is breaking into your apartment. And if nobody's breaking into your apartment, then you can be pretty sure that if anybody's in that apartment, they probably are there because you let them in. So you don't need to develop individual recognition at all because there's no way to get in there unless you lay an egg and put something there. So this is just an example of like how complex figuring out, parental behavior is. It requires not only knowing maybe about life history trade-offs, but just generally the ecology here and trying to figure out like what do you get for free from the environment? The behavior is added on top of that, but it's like, why pay the cost of complex individual recognition if you never ever need it? That's what's kind of going on here. So questions about that example, this like how cliff edges make it so that animals don't need to recognize each other anymore. Parents will just take care of whatever you put in front of them. Okay. All right. So that's, the beginnings of this parental care. So when we talk about parental care, we can bin them into kind of different groups, and they're related to sort of, they do go back to how things are fertilized and what happens after fertilization. So in the kind of simplest form of parental care, we've got, external fertilization. So in that case, you just drop eggs somewhere and a male comes by and it drops sperm somewhere. In an aquatic environment, you might just shoot eggs into the water, and then a male nearby shoots sperm into the water, and they find each other. And so the two individuals, the parents, never meet. So external fertilization doesn't usually provide a lot of opportunities for parental care because the eggs are dropped off, and then there's a delay to when they're fertilized. So the female may be separated from the eggs. The male maybe is only temporarily around the eggs, and so in these cases, then very often the insects or whatever develop and are off on their way, without any need for parental care. Now, what's interesting is there are a few cases where you actually do get some little bits of parental care. So, as an example, this is the so-called midwife toad. And so it actually collects the fertilized eggs on its back and carries these eggs around with it. So this ends up being good for it because it's in an environment where if it didn't guard the eggs, so it's like it was the last one to see the eggs, right? It fertilized the eggs. So at that point, they could either leave the eggs on their own to be eaten or whatever, or it's saying, well, you know what? It's actually worth my investment. In this environment, I can't just go taking my chances. So again, life history theory. So in this environment, I can't just go taking my chances on an egg that's just out in the environment, exposed to the elements. So I'm going to put it on my back and carry these around on my back. And then that, is a little bit of parental care. There's after they hatch out, there's very little involvement, but at least they guard the egg. So egg guarding is one opportunity when there's external fertilization. There's, of course, the brood pouches that we talked about as well. This is sort of a weird case of external fertilization because it kind of gets sealed back up right after fertilization. So it's kind of a special case, but it still sort of fits the model. And then there's a bunch of really cool cases of mouth brooding, especially in fish. There's a lot of biparental care in fish, a lot of really interesting parental care in fish. Fish are a big model for what's called alloparental care. So this is a type of cichlid. So, and it might be hard to see here, but inside its mouth are a bunch of tiny little fish called fry. It's not eating the fry, it is guarding the fry in its mouth. And this is a common thing that cichlids do and some other fish as well. What's cool about these is that they actually do form dominance hierarchies of unrelated, usually females, and the unrelated females will often brood guard or mouth brood the eggs of the dominant female. So you actually do get this kind of adoption behavior of so-called alloparental care in these fish, where you do have one parent taking care of these little fry while they're too small. They're small and it's too risky to let them off on their own, but it happens to be one that's lower in the hierarchy. And then how do you get alloparental care? That is a whole nother thing. There are a bunch of people that study these fish and study these dominance hierarchies. Ian Hamilton and at Ohio State is one example. The Taborsky is a guy in Canada, another example. But there's a bunch of people that study this system to understand these unrelated cooperative brooding, brood care that happens. But these are all sort of this kind of external fertilization case. And then you've got uniparental care, which in most cases is maternal care. You could argue that some of the things I just showed you, like this is a in this case, this frog has a bunch of tadpoles on its back, but it may as well be eggs, right? So it's not that different than the midwife toad male that I showed here. But except in the mammals. The mammals have a lot of uniparental care, particularly maternal care. And that's just because one of the key things that defines mammals is the need for milk. And you only get milk from one of the sexes. And so, but even across mammals, you get a wide range of interesting behaviors. So you've got these altricial young, which altricial means they're helpless at birth. They're often deaf, blind, and cannot move. This is a baby kangaroo. So when it's born, it looks like that. It can't do anything on its own. And so that's why it gets stuck in this pouch and it can then get nourished and continue its development outside. On the total flip side of that are, like these ungulates, they pop out and they can just walk around, move. They're almost fully functioning. So precocial young, from this term precocious. They can move around. They still need to nurse, but they're on their way to go. Primates are really weird in that they're in between. So primates are pretty much useless when they're born, but they're not this useless, right? So they can do a lot of sensory stuff. They can recognize individuals. They can make calls. They can communicate to some extent. There's a bunch of things that primate babies can do, but they can't move around. And that's why one of the weird things that you see in primates, and there are some other animals that do this, but is this idea that you'll get babies that are clinging on to typically the mother, again, for not always though, but again, because of the need for nursing. But this idea of being able to hold on to a parent, but not being able to walk around is this sort of weird and, again, it's not completely all primates, but it is very primate-y. So, and there's a bunch of people have tried to explain what's going on there, how it might relate to the size of their brain or the size of their head relative to the size of the birthing hips and all of this different stuff. A lot of it's speculative, some of it's interesting. I won't go into all of those details there, but just trying to point out that there are these sort of three different modalities that you get when you're talking about uniparental care and often maternal care in the prime or in the mammals. Yeah. Yeah, there is a I don't know if it's called a cloaca or something in I'm not up on my marsupial reproductive physiology, but there is like a slot, and there is there's opportunity for fertilization and so on. So these are marsupials, so there, it's not a placental mammal, so it's it's different, but it, yeah, it's there's basically an opportunity for it to be put into that pouch. And interestingly enough, if you see a kangaroo or many of the other marsupials on the side of the road, and you're driving down Australia, there are these, and every like their version of an area code, there's like a number you to call, like 1-800-ROO, and they ask you to check the pouch, and if you can go into the pouch and find one of these, then you can call a number and they'll collect these, and there are ways to nurse them to health. So these joeys, they it's not a total dead end for them if you can get them quick enough. And so they always encourage you whenever you see a dead roo, and you see a lot of them. I mean, they're so plentiful. They're like deer, and they eat them like venison. Like it's like pest control. Like they just multiply so quickly. But then you see a lot of dead marsupials on the side of the road, and they always say to koalas, check their joeys and things like that. All right. Anyways, I did want to get. I didn't realize I was drifting over here a little bit. I do want to mention real quick, infanticide. So biparental care sounds like a good thing. It introduces a lot of conflicts. If a male moves into a pride, a lion's, and takes over the pride, one of the first things it does is kills all the cubs, because it wants to make sure, because the female only can mate for a short period of her life. So it want to make sure that all those resources go to its cubs. Interestingly enough, concealed ovulation is one way to make it cryptic that a female has mated with another male is one way to prevent infanticide. But weirdly enough, there's also this thing called the Bruce effect, that if a female encounters a new male and she's currently developing an offspring, in some species, she will physiologically abort the offspring in order to not waste the resources, because in that species, if she were to have it, it would have gotten killed by infanticide. The last thing I want to mention then is parent-offspring conflict. Basically, the long story short here is that if you've got a benefit of feeding the offspring, which is shared with the parent, there's a cost to the parent, but there's to the offspring, the cost of extra feeding is half the parent's cost because of the relationship with the parent. They're half related to that parent. So if you were to do the economics of it, the parent wants to stop feeding here, the offspring wants to stop feeding here. And that's why you get a lot of dishonest signaling in begging behavior, because the offspring always want more than the parents willing to give. All right. So that's all I got. And we were right here at time. So let me stop there. And I'll just give you a quick clicker poll where, question is, what? Question is parental investment. Life history. So, If you're in a R selected habitat, are you more likely to be selected for behaviors that enforce quantity or quality? So is R selected more about quantity or quality?